Welcome back to the XL Talks Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Pat Ralph. I'm a staff writer at XL Sports, and I'm joined once again by my two fellow WNBA writers for the site, Emma Lydon and Eli Horowitz. How are you guys today?
Good.
I'm okay.
Great. Only okay, Eli? Not great? No? Not good? No?
Pretty good.
Okay. That's good.
The season's over, so not as exciting as when it was going on.
No, yeah. I mean, it's crazy to think. It's already been a week since the season's over. We're in the off season now, but it's kind of a quick turnaround for us because the women's college basketball season's knocking right on the door. So we're kind of in a little bit of a small limbo period in between the professional women's basketball season here in the U.S. and obviously the collegiate season. So we figured we'd come together with a little podcast here. Eli put together a great feature this week on the dual role of head coaches and GMs in the WNBA. He came out yesterday on our site. You can read it on XL Sports. And we figured it'd be a great idea to kind of do a podcast where Eli can kind of walk us through the piece, talk about how he came about the topic, his reporting process, some interesting things he found about it during his reporting and stuff. And we can just talk about that role. We figured this would be good for the listeners and the readers to kind of get an insight into our reporting process and what we're working on and show you kind of take you behind the scenes as to what we're doing and stuff. So to jump right into it, Eli, I mean, this was an incredible story you wrote. I guess to jump right into it right away, how did you come about this story idea and where did you get this idea to kind of write about this, you know, unique dual GM coach role that we're seeing in the WNBA?
Well, in the NBA this past year, two coach/GMs, Doc Rivers of the Los Angeles Clippers and Mike Budenholzer of the Atlanta Hawks, were stripped of their GM titles, and now they're just the coaches of those respective teams. And, you know, I cover both the NBA and WNBA, and I feel like in the NBA there's just kind of been a consensus, and I had included some quotes from Steve Ballmer, the owner of the Clippers, in the piece, that it doesn't work to be the coach and GM, that basically those are two full-time jobs, and to try to do them both just is not maximizing your resources. So I looked at the WNBA and said, hey, there's three people doing that, and those franchises, while they're not the Lynx or the Sparks, they're all doing pretty well, right? The Mystics made the semifinals. Connecticut is thought to be kind of the third best team in the league and probably the most promising young team. And Kurt Miller won Coach of the Year and Executive of the Year. And then in Chicago, they've been doing it for a while. And, you know, they went to a finals recently. And I think very underrated. I thought they did really well with their trades in the last few years. So I kind of wanted to find out, like, how are they making this work, especially when it hasn't worked in the NBA recently?
And you got great access. I think that's what made this piece so good, is that you were able to talk to all of them and stuff. And you were able to talk to Amber Stocks from Chicago. You were even able to talk to the owner as well in Chicago. And you also got to talk to Kurt Miller in Connecticut. And you got to talk to Tebow in Washington and stuff. And I mean, Emma, going to you on this, of those three, did you find the most, like, after reading Eli's piece, did you find to be the most interesting and most eye-opening in terms of their, you know, their job as serving as not just the GM, but also as the coach?
Yeah, I thought, I thought all three were really interesting. Your piece is great, Eli. Some really good quotes in there that kind of give you some insight into their day-to-day life. I thought that Kurt Miller was really interesting because I kind of want to see into what's happening behind the scenes on him, because as you just mentioned, he was very successful this year, got those two awards himself, but also his team went far in the playoffs, and I agree with you, they're the most promising team. So, I mean, your piece kind of mentioned his schedule and how insane it is, and if you think about it, being a GM and a coach at the same time, I don't even know how you do it, but based on your piece, I could understand why they're doing it, which we'll discuss in this podcast, but you know, he's like every hour is totally filled up with some really big time job for the team, and both roles are really important. You can't even eat lunch, you said. And so I thought that was a really interesting part of the piece.
Yeah, and I cut a quote from Amber Stocks that was very similar. She was very open about her schedule as well and sounded very similar. She talked about having to get calls forwarded to her car or leave, you know, a film session to go take a call about a potential trade. So they both kind of had similar things, and I just kind of had to pick one for the sake of the story. But yeah, I mean, just the logistics of it stood out.
Do you think, Eli, I mean, something I thought about just going off that schedule stuff, which I thought, Emma, you made a great point. Like, I found that so interesting about Kurt when he was saying, like, I barely get time for lunch. I'm going from film and player development to having to put my GM cap on in the afternoon after practice and stuff. And it's like, did you get an impression at all in the reporting and stuff? Or I'm curious to hear what both of you think on this. Is that, do you think that this puts more of it, like an example in Connecticut, in Washington, in Chicago, do you think this puts more of an onus on the assistant coaches than it does in other teams because they know the head coach is wearing more than one hat?
Well, one thing they talked about wasn't so much assistants, but all three mentioned like that their teams have kind of like a vice president of basketball operations. And so in Connecticut, for example, I think Amber Cox is probably one of the more well-known front office people, right? A lot of them talk about how they handle a lot of GM duties that aren't related to like trades or the draft, right? Like there are a lot of logistics. I thought this was interesting, like everything from like housing, like making sure all the players have housing, to making sure they all have transportation and cars, to stuff with sponsors and media and things like that. So all three said there's kind of like a vice president that handles a lot of that stuff and allows them to focus just on basketball. Whereas in other teams, like that don't have the dual head coach GM, those GMs have to do kind of like basketball and non-basketball stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like I did get that impression when you were talking about that in the story that for those three, it goes way beyond doing stuff on the court and stuff. And I know I thought it was interesting when you talked about how with Michael Alter, the owner of the Chicago Sky, it was just kind of a good point. And like, and Thibault mentioned this point too later on and stuff about how the coaches, you know, being a GM as well and stuff, you know, it's not the system of, okay, well, somebody else is figuring it out and stuff and getting the players and then handing you the keys and say, okay, now you figure it out with these players. They're the ones actually going out making the personnel decisions and the ones who are then bringing them in. So it's actually there. It's like Thibault said, it's on us. There's no one else to point fingers at. It's my responsibility to go out and get the players and then my responsibility to make it work on the court. So I think it's kind of an interesting thing that, you know, a system where they want the coach and the GM to be the same person because they want them to control all personnel matters on and off the court.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to start with an owner, and Michael Alter, the owner of the Sky, was the first person I spoke with because I wanted to understand why in the first place, like he's the one who actually makes the decision, like we're just going to hire one person for both jobs. And so I wanted to first understand why an owner might make that decision. And you mentioned the accountability was a big part. And then he also talked about the fact that ultimately, like, and it's unfortunate, but the players just get paid way less than the NBA, you know, and there's a very strict salary cap. So when you're kind of structuring your team, there's really not that much room for negotiation, if that makes sense. Like the players are kind of going to get paid what they get paid. Like there's a rookie scale and then there's like a few different tiers as you get more experience in the league. But it's not like the NBA where there's all this like all these different loops to jump through and arguing with agents about how much somebody should get paid. And so it's just really a lot less complex in terms of the contract stuff.
Yeah, I'll add to that. I think your analysis of like comparing it to the NBA is really interesting because think about how different those leagues are in terms of, you know, number of years they've been in existence, power, money, etc. Right. So I think it's really kind of this weird balance that the WNBA is trying to walk along where you know, you can't, you're at a period, obviously, of growth in the WNBA, right? We have a long way to go to get it to be even close to the kind of popularity and exposure and et cetera from the NBA, right? So when you're in this period of growth, you're trying to figure out, okay, do we give this role to fully the head coach, right? So that they completely have this strategy and this vision and it's completely lined up so that we go full force and we could really move this franchise. Or the flip side is that there's a risk in there that, you know, if everything relies on this one person's shoulders, if they make a mistake, the whole thing could go down. And we've seen that with many different franchises, you know, not being successful and folding or moving locations, like all these different things. There's a lot of shakeup in the WNBA because it's so young right now. And so I think that it's this total risk, but I also understand why they need to do that. You know, they need to, you know, have a shared vision. There's a lot more strategy, maybe not with the player negotiations like you're talking about, but there's a lot of strategy on like, how do we even get people to games, right? I mean, one thing that I read just a few months ago was that Coach Thibault for the Washington Mystics was talking about how he's trying to, you know, think about relocating the Mystics to a smaller arena so that the stands will be more packed visually and it'll be a small arena so it'll sound bigger. It'll be a different experience when you go to a Washington Mystics game. I thought that at first was kind of like, that seems a little strange to like degrade down to a smaller arena, but it actually I think is a really great strategy because you want people to go to a game and feel that atmosphere and feel the, you know, it's loud and it's packed and all that makes you want to go back again rather than, you know, it's kind of depressing when you walk into, you know, say a Sparks game that's, you know, in Staples Center with all the rafters open and, you know, there's still a good amount of fans there, but it doesn't feel like it because the stadium is so huge. So I think that there's a strategy in there that they're thinking about based on how much the WNBA has to grow. And that's not happening on the same level as the NBA. Maybe it did when it was growing in its, you know, 22nd season or whatever. But yeah, those are some thoughts I had.
Well, yeah, that's what I kind of wanted to ask you guys, because you bring up a great point. There's so much to do. And, you know, I think in my reporting, I was convinced by these coaches that it's possible because of how much simpler the CBA is. And then this 34 games, they spoke a lot about how a lot of it's just the timing because the season's over now and they can go scout the college game and prepare for the draft. But I'll be honest, like, they convince me it's possible, but I'm still not convinced it's the best route. And I'm not saying one way or the other. I feel like I'm still thinking on that. It's still marinating. But I wanted to ask you guys, you know, just from what you know and from reading the piece, I mean, do you think it's the best route? I mean, obviously Minnesota and LA and 9 other teams have a separate GM, and it's not just the draft, it's not just the scouting, it's the stuff Emma's talking about too, right? The marketing, the engagement, all that kind of stuff. So I'm wondering your guys' take, like, ultimately, do you think it's smart to have a dual coach GM, or do you think you need two different people to do that job?
I think that, you know, I can understand why they're doing it. You made a good point in your article to argue for it, but I do think that, I mean, to take it by definition, being a GM takes away from your head coaching job, right? It's not like they're sitting around, you know, on their sofa when they're, you know, not when they're doing the GM thing as if they're the head coach, right? It's like, no, they would be working. They would be doing other head coach jobs. So I think it does take away from some of those jobs or make it harder. You know, they have to crunch the time to do the same amount of jobs that they would if they didn't have the GM responsibilities. But I think, I don't know, I think ideally the WNBA should get to a point where they could have a huge team that would take on a different thing. I think what they're all three coaches talked about is the fact that they, you know, want to be on the same page. They don't want to be in a tug of war with the GM, right? So maybe that's been kind of a problem, and maybe we need the WNBA teams need to hire a staff where it all works together as like one unit. I think the Minnesota Lynx is like that. I know the director of operations, and it seems like the owner and head coach Cheryl Reeve, I mean, they all seem to be like really working well together. I know the owner gives the same resources as the Timberwolves, like stuff like that is like, if you have a cohesive unit that all works together, I think that's probably the best way to go, because everyone's working a full-time job and able to, you know, do the best they can in that rather than kind of squeeze it all together. That's kind of my initial thought.
Yeah, I think in terms of the WNBA, I think with the size and because it's a small, as you mentioned, it's comparing it to the NBA. I think, like Emma said, was really good that you did that in your piece, because as you said, the contracts are a lot simpler, the CBA, the negotiations, it's just a much simpler, everything about it is just so much simpler. It's a smaller league, so you don't, I mean, but if it's going to continue to grow, and I mean, right now, because it's smaller and stuff, it might be easier right now that where you have 3 out of the 12 teams have the dual coach GM role, and we've seen in the past, like you pointed out, 8 of the 21 teams that have won have been with coach GM, the dual role as well. Before. So it's been done before. I think as the league continues to grow, as Emma pointed out, it's going to get harder because it's going to get bigger. Salaries are going to go up. The responsibilities are only, the responsibilities are only going to increase, and it's going to just become a more strenuous job. I mean, yeah, sometimes it does work. I mean, but there's a reason that in the NBA, it's only worked as well as it did with where it's worked for two people, and it's Popovich and it's Pat Riley, and only one of them still doing it and still did it until he gave up his coaching duties. So it's all, and they're two of the five greatest coaches of all time. So it's only works for so many people. So, you know, you have to look at, you know, how do you balance? I think also too, and I've told you this, is that it's like, how do you keep that balance between, and this was the problem with Doc Rivers, and I don't want to veer too off down this route, but like, of trying to keep that role between head coach and GM and stuff. And like, the job of the GM is different from the job of the head coach, and the hats are different, and the relationship with the players is different. And if the league becomes more complex and it continues to grow, well, then the lines are going to continue. You need to keep that line pretty well marked, because the coach can obviously be more chummy and have that relationship with the players. That's not the GM's job. I mean, it's just not supposed to be. So, because they're the person at the end of the day who's in charge. So I think going forward, I think as the league continues to grow, it's going to be harder to do, because there's just so many responsibilities, and there's a reason there's only 2 out of 30, out of, you know, 30 teams in the NBA that have this. So I think it makes it easier for an owner like Alter, who can say, hey, Amber, it's all on you. You're in charge. You've got this. Go and get it. But I think as it gets more complex and continues to grow, it's going to get harder for one person to manage it all and stuff by themselves.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the sky a little bit before we wrap up and talk about our other news we need to cover. I think they're a fascinating case, because I think with Washington, like, Mike Tebow is a veteran. He's been a coach/GM before, and he was a scout in the NBA. I mean, he just has a lot of experience doing both, and they got Elena Delladone, so they kind of have a star. They're going to be competitive. Connecticut, Kurt Miller got a year to just be the coach, so he talked about that, and I had to cut that from the piece, but I wanted to mention that he was just the coach the first year and kind of got mentored by a GM and then kind of slowly took over. And again, he was able to trade Chelsea Gray for Jonquel Jones, and they have a lot of talent. And they're going to be good. So I want to talk about Chicago, because they're kind of in an interesting place. Like, they had Sylvia Fowles. She asked for a trade midseason. That was under Pokey Chapman. Then they had Elena Delladone. She's asked for a trade. And even reports from women's basketball, I think maybe it was Summit, I forget who, you know, the reports were that she even said she was going to sit out the season unless they traded her. Now, I didn't get into all that with Amber and Michael this time. So that happened. Then they traded Imani Boyette this season. Again, rumors came out that she demanded a trade. And so I wanted to kind of get, like, A, what do you think is going on there? And B, do you think that speaks to the fact that you know, they have a Cokie Chapman, now Amber Stocks, are coach and GM. Do you think that may be factoring in with kind of what's going on with players wanting to be traded and things like that? I will say, in Chicago's defense, I think they've done a really good job of getting, of winning those trades to the best they could, right? Like Elena Deladon, like the fact that they got the number two pick, Stephanie Dolson, who's an all-star, and then another player, Kalia Cooper. I mean, look at the NBA. When a star, like look at the value the Thunder got for Paul, the Pacers got for Paul George, or the Bulls got for Jimmy Butler. I mean, you're just not getting much value when you trade a star because you have no leverage. These teams know that this player wants out. Whereas I think Chicago's done a really good job getting a lot of value in situations where the player's making it clear they want to leave and they have no leverage. But, I mean, what do you guys – I mean, I know that's a lot to unpack, but what do you kind of make of all that? And do you think the fact that they have a coach slash GM is playing a role?
Well, sure, yeah. So I think the first thing for me it shows is that when you have – when you get you constantly have these trades and stuff happen where you've got Sylvia Fowles – and then Elena Deladon, and then this summer with Imani Boyette, it seems like there's just a lot of, like, I'm not saying that the team there, it seems like there's a lot of, like, instability because there's just a constant trade come and go and stuff of different players and stuff. And there's, you know, I think we have to respect that they're actively trying to find different ways to improve the team and get better and stuff. And I think we've talked about that before and stuff, but it's definitely a peculiar situation. I mean, that's what I'm just thinking about, like, I think about immediately and stuff. It's like when I constantly see a team in general just constantly making trades and doing this and that, it's partly because I just think there's a lot of instability and like you're trying to figure out what works and this piece doesn't fit or something like that. But I think that also it might be a result of the fact of like kind of what you alluded to, I think, Eli, was that the coach is the one making the personnel decisions and that they're the one who's making the trades. And they can say it's not just like, oh, they're going to the GM and saying, hey, can you – I can't coach this player anymore. I can't have her on my team. Or instead the GM's like, hey, I want to trade this player. And the coach is like, no, it's not like they're, as Emma was saying, that tug and pull back and forth. It's because the coach can say, hey, you know what? You don't want to play? Fine. I'll make the move. You know what I mean? Or if the coach sees something that maybe, Amber or Pokey in this case saw something that they felt the team was better, then they're just going to make that move. And I think that, I don't know. It's like you said. It's a peculiar situation why this has happened, not just under one coach and GM, but under two, within the span of 3 years, 2 years. So it's a lot, and so I think it's a very complicated situation that we probably don't have all the answers to yet, and not for some time.
Yeah, I think it. You kind of alluded to this, but I think that when you have those roles or in one person, yeah, it just speeds up the process, right? It just makes it so that, you know, instead of, you know, a head coach knows their players very, very well, right? They know the ins and outs of everything. The captains are very much in communication with them pretty much at all times, right? So if you have to then relay that kind of relationship with all your players and how you're, say Sylvia Fowles is not happy and you have to, you know, hash that out both as a head coach and then you go to your GM and explain it, but then it has to work with the strategy. I mean, that's a long process, right? And so maybe the fact that that's just one person, you can make those kind of decisions way more efficiently. And so that's why we're seeing such turnaround at such a high frequency. And she's just making the call as soon as she kind of sees it because she's already in tune with her team as a coach.
But just to play devil, I mean, but you had a – I mean, I don't think a team would be trying to trade Sylvia Fowles or Elena Deladon. Yeah. So that's what I'm kind of getting at. I agree with you that the fact that once they make the decision to trade or once that player says, I want out, I agree with you, Emma, now they can actually do it a lot quicker. And again, I'm not – Chicago, I think, did very well in the assets they got. They're going to have two top four picks in this draft. And I thought that getting a lottery pick for Boyette is good value. I think Boyette's unproven. She got a little over. She has potential, but I think she got kind of crowned as like this next great center. And she hasn't proven that yet. And I think to get a lottery pick that could potentially get the sky Asia Wilson was definitely worth it. So I'm not criticizing the executions of the trade. What I'm trying to get to is, why are these players wanting out in the first place? And I feel like if you had a coach and a GM, like if the coach came, if the if I was the GM and the coach came to me and said, "Hey, Elena Delladon wants to be traded, or Sylvia Fowles wants to be traded," I would say, "We're not trading her. You know, we got to figure this out. We need to sit down. What is going on here?" And so I'm wondering, when you just have one person, does it have the potential for disaster when if a player is wants to be traded, now it's like there's not that second voice in the room to say, hey, hey, let's slow down. Let's figure this out. What's going on here? You know what I mean? Because I don't know, like you, again, they did well in what they got for Elena Delladon, but I don't know why, you know, she's like a top three, four player in the league. You just don't trade people like that in their prime, right? Unless there's a specific reason.
Well, she was unhappy, though, because, you know, she was sitting in Chicago. I mean, I think there's a huge factor of, like, she wanted to go back home, wouldn't you say?
What do you mean? I mean, so, like, why was she unhappy in Chicago?
Because I think Delladon is a unique situation because, I don't know if you guys know, but she has a sister who is severely handicapped and she's very, very close to her sister, and family means the absolute world to her. And that usually is the case for a lot of people and athletes, of course. But I think when you have something as unique as her situation, it's even more important. She can't just call up her sister and connect with her that way. She has to literally touch her hands because I think she's blind and deaf and a couple other things. And so I think that she has to have a physical relationship with her in order to connect with one of the people she's closest to in her life. So I think that for Elena, it was a huge factor of wanting to be close to her home in Delaware. I mean, if you saw her career in college, that was a huge reason why she went to Delaware and she, you know, left UConn of all places. I think there's a really unique thing about Delladon. Delladon doesn't go overseas, right? She stays at home. She has another business. So I think that with her, she's sitting in Chicago and she's also not really seeing the same, you know, vision maybe that her coaches were seeing. And, you know, she's away from the people she loves. And so I think a huge part of that move to Washington had to do with like totally personal reasons.
What about Fowles then? Great insight. I agree that maybe that one can be kind of thrown out because it is so unique with the personal family. What about Fowles? I mean, you just don't trade a player like that mid-season.
I honestly, this is a total theory that I haven't even fleshed out for myself, but I think that Fowles is a little underrated when she was at Chicago, and I feel like they didn't quite see her to be what she is now and what she will continue to be. I don't think they saw her and utilized her even remotely close to what Minnesota saw in her. And I think that, you know, we can see that in the past year with her being at Minnesota. I mean, ESPN has done a lot of reporting on the analysts when watching the WNBA. They've said things like, you know, the assistant coaches of the Lynx have pushed Sylvia Fowles in a way that she's never been pushed before in her career. And they're using, you know, different padding and just a whole different kind of strategy to make her better. And I think that in her first couple years of being on the Lynx and everything, she, you know, yeah, she won a championship in 2015, but she wasn't at all the player she is now. I mean, she was missing a lot of easy buckets. And as a Lynx fan, like, that was infuriating. And then this year is when she totally came into her own and became this superstar MVP kind of caliber player. But I think when she was at Chicago, they didn't see that in her in the same way that Minnesota did. And she, a player feels that, right? If you feel that from your coach that you're not going to have the team around you and built through you and you're going to improve and be the best possible player, it's time to leave. And I think that's what she felt.
I'm just pulling up the ESPN article of the trade. Well, first of all, right. She sat out the first half of the season until they traded her. And
right.
And Elena Delladon also threatened not to play if they didn't trade her. And the Sky got Erica DeSouza and gave up a second round pick. So, I mean, think about that for a second. I mean, they got probably a second or third string center and gave up a second round pick to trade her. Because, I mean, I think they got to a point where it's like, she's not playing, so we just have to move on, right? And we're not going to get much back because we have no leverage. So, I mean, again, I hear the explanations. It's just, I mean, both these players seem to be threatening to
It's a really interesting, especially the Sevilla situation, I think is also really interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure Pokey coached her at LSU too, right? Wasn't she her coach at LSU? And I believe I believe so. Double check. I mean, that's the thing. Like, they have a relationship, but I think it goes a little bit back to Emma's point. Is it's like, okay, like maybe there was this kind of underrated thing. And like you said, since she's gotten to Minnesota, she's become this player. You know, she's become the most dominant player in the game. So, you know, maybe it's just unleashing. It's kind of like this whole, I guess, the whole Kyrie Irving thing, I guess, you know, like he's great. Like, why would he want to leave? Like, blah, blah, blah. But it's like he wants to have that opportunity to be the star and be the like to really develop and unleash. But Eli, I get where you're getting at, because like you made a great point that they've almost tripled their odds of getting number one pick in the draft lottery with that trade with Amani Boyette. And I think that they've done as well as they could have. They've brought in some good pieces and stuff from those trades. But I do think it's weird. Something's going, I don't know what it is. And I'll be honest, I come clean. I don't know that. I don't have that answer as to why you're seeing, like, as I said, you know, Emma makes a really great explanation, insight there as to why Deladon, you know, might have been traded, and you have Sylvia, and then you've got Boyette, who, as we were talking about earlier in the summer, had apparently wanted to trade out as well. So it's kind of interesting as to, you know, why is this specifically a result of, you know, the fact that we have a GM and coach dual position. And I think from what you're saying here, Eli, it sounds that from your reporting and you're doing the story, you found Chicago of these three situations. All of them are really interesting and fascinating, but it seemed like Chicago's was the most unique and the most just, you know, mind opening in terms of like, in terms of this scenario where you have the head coach and GM as the same person.
Yeah, because I felt like Washington, Connecticut, their kind of off-season strategy really fit with – like their GM strategy seems to be really fitting with their coaching strategy. Does that kind of make sense? Like the way Connecticut is building like the deepest team in the league with a lot of athleticism and fast pace, and that's in line with the moves they're making. And Washington's trying to build more of like a superstar-heavy team around Deladon, and that's the way they play, more of a half-court style. I feel like Chicago's is just so fascinating because you have like all these transactions that we're crediting them of doing pretty well on, but then on the court, we're not sure yet what this team is, you know, what they're going to be. I mean, if they get the first and second pick and get Asia Wilson and Diamond DeShields, I mean, they could turn things around really, really quick. You know, because they do it. They have some good. They have Allie Quigley and Courtney Vandersloot and Stephanie Dolson. They have shooters, but they need. I think, but they have a lot of other needs. But we just don't know. So I find that fascinating. Like this one person in Amber Stocks has to kind of balance all these things, and we're just not quite sure. And then just my last thing on all those trades. I guess that's just kind of my feeling is having a GM and coach, maybe in those situations would have helped either dissuade a player from wanting to leave or maybe catching something earlier.
Yeah. I mean, maybe there's, you know, the fact that, as I said, it's kind of going back to Emma said, it kind of speeds the process and makes it simpler where instead of you have multiple, again, there's a positive to having multiple voices in the room because you get multiple perspectives. And if you have a GM with a different perspective and a coach with a different perspective, oftentimes that helps out. But then again, if you have a coach and the GM is the same person, it streamlines the process because you're just dealing first and foremost with that person. You're dealing with one person. You're not trying to, okay, I need to go, you know, it's not like you have to go up to the GM and plead your case or something outside. It's like the buck stops here with the coach and stuff. So you're dialing direct. And I think it definitely makes it a little bit simpler and stuff. I think there is some simplicity to it where that's one of the added benefits to having that one person serving as the coach GM. What do you think, Emma?
I agree with you guys. I was just kind of thinking while you guys were talking about just like the future of Chicago, right? And I was just thinking about the draft last year. And honestly, I was wondering, and I'm sure there's an explanation that I just missed out on. Where the heck is Elena
Coates? I don't know. Let me look that up.
Did she get traded? Like, what happened with her? Does anyone know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because I was thinking, you know, they need a strong post, right? And then Eli just said, you know, they have the draft, and this year they could maybe get Asia Wilson, which would be huge for them. But, like, what happened to Elena Coates? She was the second pick last draft.
I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, I know you're obviously, we've talked about this before. You're high on this backcourt in Chicago and stuff. But I think, you know, it's so interesting. You look at this and it's like each of them have interesting scenarios, these three coach GMs. And so, I mean, Washington, I said this when we wrapped up the Mystic season when they lost to the Lynx in the semis. I said, I really don't know if there's any specific moves they need to make as much as it is, I think they need a full season out of that core of Deladon and Emma Mieseman and Chris and Tolliver and Ruffin Pratt and Taylor Hill. I think they need a full season where everyone's healthy to playing together to fully click and to have, you know, to reach their potential and stuff. Connecticut, we've talked about this and we'll have to talk about this on another podcast sometime, is what do they do with Jhenea Gumake? I mean, that is the million-dollar question. Does she get traded? Do they keep her? What value could they get for her? That is probably the number one thing on Kurt Miller's mind this offseason. And then obviously the Chicago situation where they are awaiting patiently, or not so patiently, this draft lottery, because they know they've got a great shot at the number one pick and they've got a great chance of turning in this round, because the WNBA is a league where you can quit. It's not like in the NBA or in other sports where you've got to wait a few years to get back up there. Like, if you can turn around and draft well and you add a few pieces to a good core, which they have, which we've agreed, they've got a good core. You know, whether how high you rank them or not is a different story, but you add that in with it, you add a couple of good draft pieces, that could be a team that could, you know, get into the playoffs next year. I think also too, I wanted to say, Emma, you brought this such a good point when you mentioned Cheryl Reeve and her relationship with the front office, and we're seeing now such a trend now is if you're not seeing one of these coach GM situations where they're playing the same role, like you're seeing with these three situations or what we're seeing now in the NBA in Minnesota or in Detroit, but even out of those, even in Detroit, it looks like Stan Van Gundy could be on the hot seat there, depending on what happens this year. That situation could be in flux. But I think it's interesting that so much of it now is the GM comes in and has, and almost always comes in first, and they want to hire their own head coach and stuff. And that's such a trend we're seeing now across sports now, is that the GM is almost, them and the coach have to be so hand in hand so that they're on the same page. It's not just like oftentimes when a GM steps into a situation and there's a different coach, they oftentimes will wait out the coach's contract or wait for the right time where they can make a move so they can bring their own person in. That's something that's so interesting now. So I think that's another trend we're seeing now. If they're not the same person where they're playing both roles, you're seeing that the GM is handpicking, making sure that the person they're bringing in is someone who will execute their philosophy on and off the court.
And just quickly on Coates, I mean, I was at the WNBA draft last year, and I mean, she was injured. Yeah. She couldn't even walk there. So I think she missed the season with her injury. I think they took her thinking she was the best player available. But again, it was a little odd because they had Boyette and Dolson. So you're kind of adding a third center. So I do think trading Boyette made sense to clear that up, and they got a first pick. But again, let's say they land the first pick, that's probably going to be Asia Wilson. So, I mean, then they're going to have three centers again. And I also think Coates and Dolson are both kind of, I mean, Dolson can shoot the three, so she's a little bit more, I guess she gives a little different look than Coates. But I feel like defensively, they're kind of similar styles of bigs. So I'm also kind of curious, like, I don't even know defensively if they could play together. And the team is already not the strongest defensive team on the perimeter. So I think they really need to address defense. But yeah, that Coates definitely, she missed the season injured. So, and who knows how she'll come back. I mean, it was a pretty serious leg injury.
Do you think it seems like they have a strategy where, you know, they're taking players that may not make sense based on who they already have, but they do have value, right? So maybe they're really looking in the long term here, and they took Coates so that, you know, they could trade for some, you know, they're very good at trading, like you said, you know, like
when yeah, they, I mean, yeah. I guess taking Coates allowed them to trade Boyette, and now they have two picks. So that is a strategy. It's like, if we can't beat the Lynx right. or Sparks this year, we may as well just get the most assets in our organization. Yeah. And then, you know, who knows? They might make a trade. They have two picks.
Yeah,
so
and it'll be interesting because that draft lottery is coming up. I don't know. Have they nailed down a specific date yet from the draft lottery? Do either of you know? Okay, because I'm still looking around for it. They haven't made an announcement yet. But they'll be they are going to be the most interesting team to watch that night on the draft lottery, because obviously they made that move with Atlanta. And then draft night obviously is going to be big, seeing what they do. So that should be fun. But Eli, awesome piece. It was a great read. And we're going to have to talk more about this, as we said, over the offseason, about where is Chicago, what are they going to do, and more about Connecticut and more about Washington stuff. And just really, it was really good insight you were able to get from all three of them as to the day-to-day operations of trying to do both. And that kind of actually works out perfectly, our transition here, because some news we didn't get to last week because of the finals hoopla, and we really wanted to be final-centric these last couple of weeks, but we wanted to get to this at some point and talk for a few minutes about this, was the Seattle Storm got a new head coach, and it's someone who at one point was the head coach GM role himself. He played a dual role in San Antonio, and that is Dan Hughes. He is now going to be the new head coach of the Storm. They announced it last Wednesday. The news came out last Tuesday, very late Tuesday night, early Wednesday morning, the news broke. He will be the new head coach of the Storm. He served for 11 years as the head coach and GM in San Antonio. He's not going to serve a front office role in Seattle. He'll just be coach. And so to kind of jump into this, so the Storm have a new head coach. They've obviously got a good core there with Sue Bird and Brianna Stewart and Jewel Lloyd. And they've got some fun players, obviously. They're an exciting group to build around. Eli, I know where you come from on this, but Emma, do you know that – I want to throw you this little question out there. Do you know when Dan Hughes, he was the coach for the now defunct Cleveland Rockers. I found this out. Do you know who was an assistant on his staff when he was the coach in Cleveland? None other than your favorite, Cheryl Reeve.
No, I don't. Who?
You knew it? You knew I was going to say it? No wonder. I came to you first with that question. Well,
I knew you were going to say
it. I saw that on Twitter, that Cheryl Reeve served as an assistant with him before she went to work with Bill Laimbeer in Detroit. So I thought that was a little interesting tidbit. But Emma, I'll start with you, and Bill then Eli, Laimbeer. As I said, I kind of know where you're coming from on this. But Emma, what did you make of the hire and stuff? What do you think about Dan Hughes taking over in Seattle?
I think it's a really interesting move that he came out of retirement to take the job. I think that's really interesting. He must have really seen something in the franchise. I mean, like you just said, the players are awesome. Like, you have such a core to build around. You have a lot of freedom with that. And, you know, you have Sue Bird, who is probably one of my favorite players, who, you know, is just a legend. And so you have that as the core of your team. So I think it's an exciting position for him to take. I'm really kind of curious on what will happen now that, yeah. What's his name? Gary Kloppenberg, right? The interim head coach, right? What's going to happen with him? Because I honestly think that he did a great job. I think that's kind of proven in the fact that they, you know, went to the playoffs and, he kind of turned that team around. They didn't look like they were going to make the playoffs and once they fired the head coach. And so then he steps in and kind of, you know, totally turns the whole season for the better. So I'm interested to see, like, you know, will he be stepped back down to an assistant coach? That's kind of an awkward situation.
I don't know. They haven't made an announcement.
Or will he move on? Like, I don't know. Any thoughts on that?
They haven't made an announcement yet in terms of, I don't know of what is going to happen with him. I guess, not totally surprised, but I mean, I was a little bit like, oh, okay, I figured there might be a chance he'd get a shot. Interesting point, Emma, you brought up there. After he took over, when he took over, they went on a 4-game win streak when he took over. However, though, after the win streak, they lost 3 of their last 4 games to close out the season before they lost in the playoffs at Phoenix. He did get them in. I think there was, I think that was one thing I found interesting at first, because I was like, oh, wow, he like, I remember looking at that at the end of the season, like, wow, Seattle's coming in playing really well. But then I looked at it, I was like, it was maybe just more of like a regress to the mean after that win streak. But there hasn't been an announcement yet about where he's going. I mean, Eli, I don't know if you've heard anything yet on that front, but I know what you're feeling about the hire, so I want to hear what your take is here.
I mean, Dan Hughes is obviously a decorated coach, but you know he has a losing record overall in his career. And granted, like when he's had talent, he took San Antonio to the playoffs multiple times. Didn't quite get them over the hump to a title, but I know his last four seasons were losing seasons. I mean, it's not personal to Dan Hughes. I think I just would have liked to see somebody new get an opportunity, you know, maybe a female, maybe a person of color. It just seems like, I don't know, I hate to be that guy, but it just seems like another white male who's getting like a second, third, fourth chance. That doesn't mean he's not a good coach. It's just, you know, they made this hire during the WNBA finals. Like, there's no rush. There's a lot of time before the season. I know you want to fill someone, but I just don't get the impression that there was an exhaustive coaching search. I mean, there are some great assistants in LA, great assistants in Minnesota, and, you know, Michael Cooper, for example, who was fired in Atlanta. I mean, he's a great defensive coach, and Seattle needs defense. They had a top four offensive rating in the league, but their defense is horrible. So, I don't know. I guess I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt to see what he does.
I mean,
but
I think
just,
this is all
my
about,
issue is more that I don't
kind of,
feel there was an exhaustive
the centerpiece
process.
Of all this is, I think, I saw a photo on Twitter the other day. Brianna Stewart tweeted it out. She was like, look who showed up to my workout. And it was a picture of her and Dan Hughes posing for a photo. And this is all about, I think, coming out of retirement for this, this is the potential of being able to coach a player like Brianna Stewart who, you know, I think – Brittany Griner, don't hold me to this quote, but she pretty much said she's running around out there like she's a chicken with her head cut off. Like she's just learning how to do this stuff and she's doing so well. Like she's only in her second year. And so, I mean, she's going to be a top, you know, I don't know where, but probably top 3-5 player in this league at the rate she's going because of her ability to score, defend, able to do ability to do just about everything on the floor for Seattle and build this team around them. It kind of reminds me, Eli, and I'm curious what you think, or Emma too, on this, is like, you look at, it reminds me a little bit, is like, I feel like the ceiling for with, as you said, his career record is 230, I have it in front of me, 237 and 287 coaching San Antonio, Charlotte, and Cleveland. It seems like this is kind of like, as you made a good point, this reminds me is like, as if, you remember, like when George Karl in the NBA always gets hired somewhere new. And then again, George Karl is a great coach. He's won over 1,000 games. He's been to the finals. I'm not saying he's a bad coach. What I'm saying, though, is like I feel like there's a defined ceiling with Dan Hughes. Do you feel that's the case here, either of you on this? Like, do you feel that there's a defined ceiling, that Seattle can only go so far with him as head coach? There's somebody else, like you said, Eli, that there's another sister who can maybe lead this team over the hill?
Right. I think it's like he has experience, so I understand why they wanted someone with experience to work with Brianna Stewart and Jewel Lloyd. But I just feel like I would have wanted a young, fresh voice to kind of grow with them. Somebody who had maybe experience winning as an assistant, right? Like somebody on Minnesota or LA staff. You know, for example, look at Chicago. They took a risk. We'll see if it works out with Amber Stocks. But I feel like there's when you do something like that, there's a higher ceiling and also a lower floor. And I maybe would have, again, maybe I wouldn't have gone in that direction ultimately. Maybe I wouldn't have gone in that direction ultimately. But I feel like they even interview these people. I don't know. You know, like they couldn't have interviewed anyone from LA and Minnesota
no
because the finals were still going on when they made the announcement.
They don't have anything. There's no reason to necessarily make a hire right now because the offseason doesn't really – the player movement doesn't happen almost until deep into the winter. Emma, what do you think about it?
Well, I want to – kind of elaborate a little bit more on what Eli first mentioned, which I think we cannot brush over, which is the fact that, you know, here's another white male coming right into this position, getting another chance, right? So I actually worked at the Tucker Center, which is the research center for women and girls in sport, which is one of the only research centers that, you know, looks just at women and girls in sport. And a lot of their research is groundbreaking and really incredible. I hope the listeners kind of look into them. But one of the things that we were researching when I was there, and they've continued to really build on it, is this declining number of female coaches for women's sports teams, right? So back when it was Title IX, right, we had like 90% or even more were female coaches coaching women's sports, right? And now, today, that number has completely declined to now 40% of women's the coaches coaching women's teams are women, right? And so if you look at the WNBA in general, there's 12 teams. There's five head coaches that are women. Five, right? I mean, if you flip that, we don't even need to really make that argument. But if you flip it on the NBA, right, there's zero, right? Becky Hammon is like the one assistant coach. There might be Nancy Lieberman, I think, as well. But there are assistants, right? And that's been like a huge storyline over the past couple of years on how they're, you know, pushing the glass ceiling and this whole thing, right? It just doesn't work at all in the same way. So what's really interesting is that, yeah, they had an opportunity to have this open spot, and it's not like women are not qualified. It's not like there's, you know, look at who just won the championship. That was a female head coach in Cheryl Reeve, right? So I think when, you know, there's a common misconception that like, oh, women aren't applying to it or things like that. But you have to seek out women in a different way. And I think that what you just brought up, Eli, of like, you know, they had time. They didn't need to rush this decision or do it during the finals, I think is kind of a bizarre thing. So they had the time to actually, you know, the WNBA is all about pushing, you know, women, which is the product here, women forward. And they didn't take that opportunity. And they said they just filled it with, you know, the standard kind of, you know, demographic that has been dominating women's sports. And so I think that that was a really missed opportunity. And I think, you know, it just is another, I don't think people are thinking of it as overtly as like, oh, you know, let's hire the white male right now, right? Of course he's qualified. Of course there's other things involved. But I think that it is a chance where it does require some kind of deliberate thinking of like, okay, what are we trying to push forward here? We just fired a female head coach, right? Now we're going to replace it with a man. Like, that's just an interesting decision, I would say, to say it frankly. Well,
that's the other thing, like you mentioned, to announce in the WNBA finals to me suggests – again, I haven't talked to anyone in Seattle, but think about it. Would you, if you were really proud of the hire and just was like, oh my God, we're so excited about this new coach,
right?
Why, I don't know, why would you bury it during the finals as opposed
and I mean,
to maybe
I think the thing with this
it two
is that it's like,
days
okay,
after.
Can Seattle, can he get Seattle
something there
to the playoffs
I
again next
know.
Year? Absolutely. This team should be a playoff team. They shouldn't be in a spot where they were this past year, where they're barely scrapping in and stuff. I think we can agree with that with the talent they have with Breanna Stewart there leading the way. I mean, and you've got Jewel Lloyd who's going to be a star, and you've still got Sue Bird there, her leadership. This is a team that shouldn't be scrapping into the playoffs on the last day of the regular season. But I don't think this is a guy, as you said, this is not going to be a guy who gets them, I think, any closer to closes the gap with Minnesota or Los Angeles at all. But it's kind of just like, I don't know. I think it's a really interesting move. And you guys have both made great points on the front about hiring females. Like you said, Emma, the woman who just won it has won four WNBA titles and only, you know, she's tied for the most in the league's history. So clearly a woman knows how to do the job, if anything. So you guys make really good points on that aspect. And really too, you think about it, I didn't even think of that, was the fact that the report came out at midnight on the East Coast of the Tuesday, Wednesday, between the 3rd and the 4th there, midnight of the 4th, that this story broke. It was just kind of a very peculiar time to let it out before Game 5 of the WNBA finals. Just an interesting move. And as you said, there's other teams like Atlanta right now. They still have to make a coaching decision. We don't know anything on that front yet, but they seem to be taking their time and they're in no rush. So it's just an interesting decision making on the part of the Storm.
Yeah.
it's the safe move. And I don't think the safe move is going to get you over the hump when you have teams like LA, Minnesota, and even Connecticut. You know, I think
it gets you maybe a home move game might get you from the eighth seed. It's a low risk, sixth seed, or the low fifth reward seed. Move. What you're saying?
You're not taking that
high risk. It's like, hey, like we're going for the new one. And like he or she hasn't necessarily coached at hasn't been a head coach yet in the league. But you know what? You're going to give him or her that chance and see what they can do and stuff. Is it like, you know, as I said, one of these assistants from Minnesota or Los Angeles, like Kurt Miller. I mean, again, it's another white male, but look at him. I gave him he was an assistant in LA. Connecticut gave him the opportunity and look where he is now after 2 years. So yeah. Right. Right.
All right. And Amber Stocks in Chicago. She was an assistant in LA as well. And again, we don't know if the Sky are going to be good under Amber Stocks, but I like that approach of saying, let's go for it because we're so far behind Minnesota. We need to take a risk here.
And think about the, you know, the future of the league, right? I mean, that's not something that they're not thinking about. That's what everyone's thinking about is how do we grow this league? And so if you're taking someone who's kind of already had this whole career coming out of retirement, like that, it just seems like that's kind of going backwards rather than like, let's get someone fresh in or someone, you know, an assistant who's like ready to step into that role. Let's build them into, you know, the next big powerhouse coach that's going to take over once, you know, all these coaches right now, you know, slide out and finish their careers. It's like, you need young, you need, you know, experience, but you need, you know, the step forward.
So, yeah, so we'll have to see like what happens and stuff. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, they have some interesting things to address. They have the number five pick in the WNBA draft this year. And they also have to address the free agency of Crystal Langhorne. She's scheduled to be a free agent this year. So she's a big part of what their team does. She's a consistent scorer for them. So it'll be interesting to see what they do there. But I think it was really interesting. We kind of broke that down along with our talk today about the dual head coach GM role because he did serve that position before. So this was great. I think we hit on just about everything. If I'm not missing anything, we'll wrap this thing up. This was great. Eli, again, great job on that piece. Really enjoyed reading it and stuff. And we encourage everyone to go check it out on xlsports.com. Go check it out, read all about, what these three head coach GM dual, the three of them are doing in the league and how they juggle both positions and stuff. So great speaking to you guys as always. Both of you, thanks for joining me. Yeah, go right ahead, Emma. If it doesn't have to do with the Lynx winning the championship, go ahead. Oh, okay.
Thanks
here we
so
go.
Much.
What's
Can
new?
I make
here
a
we go.
Little plug? It does,
it's a
12-team
league. Anyway, go ahead.
You know there's other teams, right?
Yeah. Okay, anyways, one of my roles at XL Sports is to take on the shop, which a lot of people don't even realize we have an XL Sports shop. But just to tell our listeners just a little bit of what we offer not only the news and the features of our brand, but we also have a curated marketplace with all different sports where you can find gear if you're an athlete yourself or you want to know what professional athletes recommend or all these different parts that relate to clothing and style and fashion. So you can check that out at xlsports.com and there's a tab at the top that says shop. And one of our newest collections is actually a Minnesota Lynx championship gear collection. So you can get the latest kind of WNBA shirts that commemorate their season, and there's also there's a whole WNBA section in there under fan gear. So
Emma's already bought all of her gear and stuff. She's already got all the championship hats.
Just a thing to check that out would be maybe some people are looking for that.
Yeah, so there you go. There you have it. So
I
rock
my Lamar jersey every single game.
We're on iTunes.
Game of the
check
finals,
us out.
So
go
calling
on your
that
phone.
Lucky.
Hit the podcast app. That purple button there, you always see it comes there. It's just like, ah, do I want to touch it? Do I want podcast? You should hit that button. Search XL Sports in your feed. You can hit subscribe. It'll pop right up in your podcast feed. So every day, anytime there's a new episode, we got something, we'll be right there ready for you. So we thank everyone for tuning into this episode. And make sure to please go check out Eli's piece online now when you get a chance. It's a great read. You won't regret it. And we'll be back soon with another podcast of the XL Talks Basketball Podcast. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.